BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Hello and welcome to the 21st of March edition of Dialect. The show is coming to you from the Bristol City Centre and is part of the Bristol Radio Co-op at dialectradio.co.uk. Hello Bristol, and also to our listeners in Preston and our new audience in South America. Our guest in this week's studio is Susie Fitzsimmons from Lifeline organisation, which supports prisoners, in particularly those in death row in the US, the Caribbean and South Africa. We have an up-to-date report on the Gaza convoy, an exclusive on fluoridation in Bristol's water, as well as the usual mafia piece and Diana. Instead of the Pisco earthquake item we promised you last week, we have a feature from Dialect's reporter Anthea Page. Last weekend at the Watershed was a screening of the film Fire Under the Snow, a film about the imprisonment and torture of a Tibetan monk. Anthea interviewed Petan Gyatso after the screening and Philippa Carrick, the chief executive of the Tibetan Society in London. Malcolm Greaves reads another chapter of the history of the Mafia. Rachel Edmondson's back with her guitar and a new song. And Jeff Sparks rounds up the show with his latest What's On. Dialect can bring you an exclusive this week, which, if it goes through, will affect the water quality of everyone in Bristol and beyond. After being rejected several times in the past, fluoride is back again. Plans to add fluoride to all Bristol water supplied to homes in the old Avon area was raised quietly at last week's Bristol City Council Health Scrutiny Committee. In Southampton last month, a referendum was held on the issue where the public rejected fluoridation, but the Health Trust still decided to go ahead. I spoke to Councillor Jenny Smith, Labour Bristol City Councillor for Southmead.
I'm Jenny Smith. I'm a member of the Bristol City Scrutiny Committee. This was brought to us as an issue where we were asked to support an investigation into the fluoridation of Bristol water.
Now, is that for the whole of Bristol, or is it just the investigation just going to take place in one little area?
No, it's for the whole of the old Avon area. So any water supply that Bristol shares with South Gloucester, Bath and North East Somerset, North Somerset, any other areas, Kingswood area, they would also hopefully be part of this consultation so that they have a say.
Okay, so is there any problem with putting fluoride into our water? Surely, I mean, we all use it in toothpaste and things like that, or many of us do. What's the difference if we just sort of stick it into the water instead?
Well, there seems to be some independent research around which hasn't been taken into account by the government or the health trusts. There's research in America where many areas have actually stopped putting fluoride into their water, where horses had terrible trouble with their hooves. There's also research that shows that cats, and I acknowledge that many cats won't touch the water we've got anyway up a tap, won't touch anything with fluoride in. There's a Dr. Durant Petfield who actually addressed the Natural Water Conference 2 years ago, who said they were concerned about it causing thyroid disorders in people. The Alliance of Natural Health is certainly against fluoridation in water. And while I'll accept that it probably does help with childhood tooth decay, it also seems to have lots and lots of implications for older people. Possibilities that it affects the and causes broken hips, which many of us would be concerned about as we get older. There's also a Liverpool University found significant difficulties with growing crops when fluoridated water was added to the soil. And that has implications for allotment holders throughout our area. I understand that Holland has banned it and not accepted it, that China was worried that it was having an effect on the IQ of their children and has decided to withdraw it because they started using it. And I think that what we should be asking for as a city, as the old area that used to encompass Avon, is for true scientific investigation to take place. And when I listened to the report that came before us at the City Council Scrutiny Committee, I wasn't assured that that was what was taking place. It was almost like we will prove it's okay. No, true scientists look at everything and then decide whether something's safe.
Well, this chap, Dr. Durant Peatfield, that's D-U-R-R-A-N-T, P-E-A-T, Field. I mean, people can search for him and have a look at videos about him and things like that. He's someone who was speaking out against it, and then he's suddenly he's lost his job, which does sound a little bit suspicious. But what's the procedure that the council has to go through, or who is it that actually decides, so people know how to follow this?
Well, the council will have a part to play in the decision. And can I remind the older members of the residents in Bristol that we, as an old authority, had always resisted fluoridisation in water.
So has there been pressure in the past then to do this?
Yes, over many, many years there's been resistance. I was talking to someone from Bath recently at a conference, and he said, I'm amazed, it's come back again. He said, as far as he was concerned, this was proved to be something we didn't want to do because it had other implications for the health of the wider community, not just for the children. And yes, we want the children to have good teeth, and if their parents want them to, they can use fluoride toothpaste. But for the rest of us, what effect would it have on the things we grow, the animals we live with, and ourselves into old age?
So who's actually going to make the decision? Is it the council, the health authority, or Bristol Water?
Well, the Health Trust, but I understand that they have the Water Board on side, so that possibly it will be the Health Trust and Water Board. But with the vote in Hampshire and Southampton, unanimously the people rejected fluoridisation in their water, and it has been completely overruled by the Health Trust. And that worries me, because that's democracy. That's not listening to people.
So there's something called health scrutiny, isn't there, on Bristol City Council? How do people, if they're interested to follow this in the future, how do they find out when those meetings take place and to what extent the public are allowed access to it?
Well, that's not on the website, although the reports and the agendas are. So it's not part of the council that you can actually click into and see what the debate is about.
But aren't they public meetings, though, some of these?
Public meetings, you can come to them. You can also present questionnaires at the beginning, statements, and I would hope the public in Bristol ask lots and lots of questions about the science behind all this and whether it's safe.
Now, do you know anything about the kidneys? Because I've been doing a little bit of research and found that also fluoridisation, some scientists believe that it really has an adverse effect on your kidneys.
Yeah, I've heard that as well. Dialysis uses water. And if water already has a lot of additives in it, there's hydrogen, magnesium, silicone, sodium, calcium, all added at the moment to our water supply, and this will add fluoride. And we don't know what the impact will be with all those chemicals inside our water.
Because of course, the main principle here really is about enforced medication, isn't it? The Health Trust are saying is that actually what we'd like to do in order to so we don't have to look after people's teeth so much, for example, is just if we put a little bit of fluoride in everybody's water, then hopefully not so many people will be reporting to the dentist. Isn't that essentially what they're trying to do?
That's what the thinking is behind it. What I'm saying is I want it proved beyond any doubt that scientifically it's safe. And I still have concerns that the science has not been fully looked into.
Labour councillor for Southmead, Jenny Smith there, talking to me this week about new plans afoot to force fluoride medication on nearly 1 million people in and around Bristol. You can follow this issue by going along to health scrutiny meetings at Bristol City Council, which are open to the public. Unfortunately, dates and times of these health scrutiny committee meetings, although they're open to the public, are usually not available on Bristol City Council's website. Silly me, I thought that's what the website was for. Send your writs, as usual, to Stephen McNamara, Head of Legal Services, Bristol City Council, College Green, Bristol, BS1 5TR. Into our next item, which is Susie Fitzsimmons from Lifelines, a charity. Thanks for joining us in the studio today, Susie.
Hello.
Now, can you tell us how this Lifelines charity first started? Because the idea is that you're in touch with prisoners.
Yes, it's a letter-writing organisation, a charity, which began in 1988, so that's over 20 years ago. And it started under the most extraordinary circumstances, really. There was a wonderful man who is the founder of Lifelines, called Jan Ariens, a translator, and he was just channel hopping on his TV one November evening, and there was a programme on BBC which showed a film called 14 Days in May, which showed the last 2 weeks of a guy called Ebedel Johnson's life on death row in Mississippi. At first, Jan thought he wouldn't watch this thing, but then he became gripped by it. It was so horrendous. And the story was that this young man, Ebedel Johnson, typical candidate for death row arrest, was arrested for a supposed homicide, murder of a couple of policemen, and rape. And he was 18 at the time, had no idea of his rights, so he didn't ask for any legal support. And he wound up on Mississippi's death row. And of course, the southern states, all those states, have got the worst conditions and history for the condemned. Of course, it's the heart of the Deep South, has its links with slavery. And Ebedel Johnson himself says we have slavery in our consciousness still. Anyway, this young man was a really guileless, and he was innocent, in fact, and later proved to be so. And during the last 2 weeks of his incarceration, almost all of the staff were aware of this, including the executioner, Don Cabana, who has since spoken to Lifelines at one of the conferences.
So the thing is that certainly in the Western world, so the state periodically decides that it really does need to retain the death penalty as a final sanction and a deterrent. So and we, you know, from time to time in the tabloid press we hear it's time to bring the death penalty back.
That's right. There is actually very much movement towards the abolition of the death penalty worldwide now. America, unfortunately, leads the way in incarceration, numbers of prisoners on the row, length of incarceration. During Clinton's time, even, he raised the number of felonies that were culpable by death, capital punishment. So things are pretty bad still. America has got the worst record worldwide, in fact. The numbers on death row in America, men and women, well, there's 3,500 men approximately on death row in America and 50 women. But there's a lot of good things happening. There's definite seeds of doubt about the use of deterrent through capital punishment. There's a lot of publicity now. Capital punishment's in the public forum.
But do you think that there's still, in some occasions when someone is particularly dangerous, that the death penalty, that the state needs to retain that and the judicial system needs to retain it?
Yes, there is a move towards life without parole, which is quite a valid
alternative. So that's incarcerating people forever, but it's not actually
a
death penalty.
It is, no. And there are actually increasing numbers of minors, if you like, under 18-year-olds with that punishment. But it doesn't statistically show to be a deterrent.
Anyway, you started back in 1988. How have things gone since then? I assume that you've grown, but to what extent? How many people are involved with Lifeline now?
Well, it has grown enormously. There are now about 1,400 people writing to death row prisoners in the States as well as the Caribbean and South Africa. And they are always looking, in fact, for more, particularly people who are Spanish-speaking. Yes, Lifelines has organised itself and has conferences on a twice-yearly basis, which are addressed by lawyers, exonerated prisoners.
But do these letters that you're sending, do they really make a difference? I think some people will think, well, just sending a letter is not going to get someone out of jail.
Definitely offers huge amount of hope, because these guys are basically forgotten by society. They've lost their families, if they had any. There's an increasing move to build prisons out in the desert and underground, and families cannot afford or get to visit. They're usually isolated, and of course they're in solitary, perpetual solitary confinement, so they lack human contact. Even in the yards, so-called exercise yards, which are only 30 foot by 40, varying state by state, they're in cages. In their cells, they not only have bars, they have mesh. So there's no opportunity for real human contact.
Now, ever since 9/11, we've had this sort of spectre of this rendition with prisons being moved around the world, including places like Guantanamo. Now, even though Guantanamo is being closed, apparently now, there are still other places. Do you get involved with those at all? Other prisons?
Outside of the US and Cuba.
Yeah, well, there are apparently some in Pakistan, in Africa, other places around the world. I mean, it must be quite difficult to keep track of some of these prisoners.
I can't say beyond the States. I know a certain amount about Cuba. Of course, we all know quite a lot about Cuba since we've had lot talks from people like Mozambique for quite a long time. Even in Bristol here. But Clive Stafford Smith, who is the main advocate for prisoners in Guantanamo, I think he only lost... He also represents people on death row in the States. He's only lost 7 out of 300-plus cases.
Well, that's a pretty good record, isn't it?
Pretty amazing.
What about death row syndrome? Because, you know, sometimes if people are kept in solitary confinement or they're in death row for too long, it can just really be a problem in itself, cause mental illness.
That's right. The prisoners go through all... If they're usually incarcerated unless executed earlier, but it's up to a 30-year span. So during that time, they go through all the stages of total numbness, you know, the pain, suicide, which is difficult there, of course, and total withdrawal. And then, very much through the letters, they gain their link with the outside world, and they go through a very painful stage of feeling again and remembering the lives they had when they were in the other world.
So do some prisoners then form friendships with people who are writing letters?
Of course, if you write a letter, it's about a relationship. It's a two-way process. There's various... Lifelines tries to give guidelines mainly to protect the prisoner, not to become involved in a personal way. Hard to put it really, because of possible disappointments and the negative effect it can have. But you can't write to someone in that situation and give and take without there being a relationship.
What about the future?
Well, there's good things ahead. Certainly, Clive Stafford Smith, this great lawyer, he is very optimistic and feels that capital punishment will soon be in the history books as something of the past.
Well, that's nice to hear. Now, how about, we can find you on the internet, it's lifelines.co.uk or lifelines.org.uk, we're not quite sure which. But can you just give us your email address as well if people want to contact you on the internet?
Yes, that's fine. Cathy Sue with a C, Cathy Sue at blueyonder.co.uk, and I can also link anybody up with the people, organisers, Claire Collett and the chairman of Lifelines. There are coordinators representing each state with lots and lots of useful support and information for anyone who thinks they might like to join and write.
Susie Fitzsimmons, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect today. Okay, now joining us in the studios, our regular musician guest is Rachel Edmondson. Rachel, what have you got for us today?
It's a song called Maybe It's Nothing.
Okay, off you go.
Weaving in and out of where the wild things grow. Consciousness evaporates just like freshly fallen snow. Walking with your face against wet wind and cold air. Dignify your dream. Your soul is challenged to prepare. And the waxing and the waning are the thoughts inside your mind. Creation cries out, and the time of life is soon. Does this time have a beginning and an end? Soul searches at the gate, and who knows what they'll send. Memories just like a dark and frozen corridor suddenly escapes you, and into your vision pours a devil of awakening that can no longer find a reason to be dormant, share within this space and time. Memories just like a dark and frozen corridor suddenly escapes you, and into your vision pours a level of awakening that can no longer find a reason to be tormented yet within this space and time. But do not have a reason to dim their grateful glow, the turning of the season. Like this life I'll grow, like the branches of the trees reaching in the clear blue air. Hypnosis, I'm escaping to nothing, I will not stare. Create or be created, that life path you'll see. Intuition framing pictures, and they're tagging you and me. Well, it was the heart that made the craziest of goals. Make sure your head don't make you like the blueprint, like the mold. Well, it was the heart that made the craziest of goals. Make sure your head don't make you like the blueprint, like the mold. All of us are changing, yet the part that stays the same cannot be quantified, not by color, not by name. Let the waxing and the waning of your thoughts will prophesy. Uh-huh, these tones in rhythm shall appear and drift and glide. All of us are changing, yet the part that stays the same cannot be quantified, not by color, not by name. Yet the waxing and the waning of your thoughts will prophesy. How these tones and rhythms shall appear and drift and glide.
Something there from Rachel Evanson called Maybe It's Nothing. Rachel, where can we find you on the internet?
myspace.com/queensofpretension.
Queens of Pretension.
Yeah,
thank you.
I'm trying to form a band.
That's you. That's you, is it? Just on your own at the moment?
Yes, but I'm trying to form a band. I've got one person at the moment.
Okay, well, maybe they'll have an update on that next week. Our reporter Anthea Page was at the Watershed in Bristol last weekend for the screening of Fire Under the Snow, a film about the imprisonment and torture of a Tibetan monk over a 33-year period in Chinese prisons and labour camps. This is an interview with the monk himself, now out, Paldun Gyatso.
My name is Ugyen Nobu. I related with Tibet Society, and I'm only a translator for Panden Gyatso. The Panden Gyatso is a Tibetan monk who was put in prison by the Chinese in 1959 for 33 years solemnly, and he has suffered a great deal, and he came out from prison. He became 61. Within a month of release, he came to India. He traveled around the world to advocate what the Chinese have done to Tibet and his conviction that Tibet was an independent nation and the Chinese have mistreated for the Tibetans and tried to destroy the Tibetan culture and Tibetan way of life, Tibetan nationhood for the last 50 years. And although Dalai Lama has given a constructive suggestion to the Chinese and that to live within the Chinese nationhood, but with the Tibet autonomous, run by the Tibetans, what the Tibetans call meaningful autonomous, but those Tibetan suggestions, His Holiness Dalai Lama's suggestions, were rejected by the Chinese. Then Gyatso is here to speak about those issues, and recently there was a film made about him and about his conviction, about his stand, and how much he suffered in these prisons. And so he came to speak about that.
Can Bandung Gadso now tell us about his film?
Bandung Gadso, it's a film called Six Song Dance.
That day, in the near Chevy, you know, Tanganzo Purdy, Jana Mavi Shungi, Tenzu Cheney, Wong of Chukuaris.
So it's the 50 years since the Chinese occupied and subjugated Tibet.
What monastery was he in?
It's called Gadong Monastery, in his a smallish monastery in his near his village, where he first went, and then his main monastery is Debung Monastery in Lhasa.
Were all the monks taken prisoner from that monastery and imprisoned?
Most of the monks from Debung Monastery were put in prison at the time. So the monks were arrested and put in the monastery confines, not allowed to leave, and some of them put in other prisons. So they were not fed and also not allowed to go to toilet, and they have to excrete and urinate in the same, and that has been horrible.
So what was the crime?
And quando du doni karichin songa te wo doni karichin duga di karicheris
duga cheta maji keyo mare sibamja ni songa chubres tine.
So there is no accusation of crime as such, but they just literally put all monks in prison.
But why for so long? One of the reasons he's staying for 33 years in prison was that partly conviction that he believes Tibetan independence, and he advocated that Tibet was an independent nation and the Chinese came here to invade us and you should go back. He maintained that position throughout. He has put posters, and therefore they put him in prison and totally 33 years. So am I allowed to ask if they tortured him?
So many tortures occurred to him. So initially hand and leg shackling, and then holding his arms at the back and leg, and they're hanging in the ceiling and putting fire under there, and then beating them up and saying that now you are getting independence. Where is your independence? And this is your independence. So those kind of languages. And then later in life, electrode rod put on his mouth, and in the early his ages, all his tooth were broken. You can see this is artificial tooth which he has got. But his teeth were broken long time ago.
About the Tibetans now, does he know anything about the situation in the country at present?
Chikyage Sekyu Kungeni Jiren.
sochu kungke kanka ka re ene ta thela thanda ini kanga shugu yare ni kanji mo chilo ma tang ba che ma mi mang bu tam ini kanga shugu yare
there is a crack total crackdown total lockdown of Tibet. No journalists, international journalists are allowed. No travelers are allowed. No travels, too much travels between the within the Tibetan areas, and they put military everywhere. It's, Tibet is like caged. It has been caged for the last 50 years. The Tibetan people, who are most of the Tibetan people you see here in England or anywhere, they are all escaped. There is no independent travelers. So no one is able to travel to Tibet if you are Tibetan, unless you have a special understanding with the Chinese.
Am I allowed to ask if there's an underground movement?
There is a resistance, strong resistance by the people, and it has been strong resistance. Last year you have seen 2008, and the Chinese crackdown is very severe, but still they are continuing this year as well. They are resisting the Chinese oppression.
That was Anthea Page. Now it's time for our regular What's On Man, Jeff Sparks.
Good evening, this is a What's On Guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Friday 27th of March, at the Dorchester Arms, which is at 38-40 Onslow Road in Southampton, Noisy Toys will be headlining with support from When Memories Fade and also the Rubicon. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £2 on the door. Also on 27th of March and at the Prom Bar in Bristol, Tail Feather will be performing. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £5 on the door. On to Song of the Week, and when I heard the news that Skin were reforming after being away for 11 years and performing at this year's Download Festival, I just had to play a track by one of the greatest British rock bands of the 1990s. Hasta la Vista Baby was recorded live on their farewell tour and released in 1998, and there is a track from that album, and it is titled Perfect Day.
Yeah.
That was Skin with Perfect Day from the album Hasta La Vista Baby. For more information on them, you can check out www.skindex.co.uk. Moving on to Saturday 28th of March, and at the Fleece in Bristol, Stone Gods will be performing with support. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £12 in advance. Also on 28th of March and at the Reckless Engineer in Bristol, the Rock and Blues Power Trio Third Stone will be performing. The gig starts around 9 p.m. and entry is free. Finally, on Sunday 29th of March and at the Junction in Bristol, Cross-Stitched Eyes will be performing with support from the A-Heads and also Jesus Bruiser. Doors open at 7 p.m. and entry is £5 on the door. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
The affable, the unflappable, Jeff Sparks. Now it's time for The History of Organised Crime, our regular series here on Dialect, and this is a book by David Southwell, read by Malcolm Grieve.
The History of Organised Crime by David Southwell. The naturally memorable nature of identical twins being crime lords and the publicity surrounding them may have made Ronnie and Reggie Cray the most iconic English gangsters of the 20th century. But two other brothers will go down in history as having headed London's most feared and respected organised crime family in the 1960s. Charlie and Eddie Richardson ran what even Ronnie Cray later called a mightily powerful and feared organisation. The Crays might have held the East End of London in their grip and been a major power in West End clubland, but the Richardson gang ruled the underworld roost in South London. According to former Billy Hill gang member Frankie Fraser, who had eventually joined the Richardsons, comparing the Crays and the Richardsons were miles in front in everything, especially brain power. I was brought up on family tales of the Richardsons. The comic cliché of them being good to their mother was even given credence by my own mother, having attended both family picnics and weddings with them. The widespread mythology that the Crays made the streets of East London safe from petty crime is much less pronounced around the Richardsons. However, in reality, it seems to hold much more truth, as I've met more than one South London villain who received a smack from Charlie Richardson and was told to piss off up the West End and steal from some fucking rich bastards. Charlie was born in 1934 and his brother Eddie in 1936. The sons of a former prize fighter, they grew up in Camberwell, South London. Charlie's early career in petty crime was interrupted by his call-up for national service, during which he received a court-martial for his attitude and insubordination, and served time in Shepton Mallet Military Prison alongside the Crays. He founded a legitimate and profitable scrap business that had a chain of 5 yards across South London and a string of drinking clubs. He fled to Canada in 1959 when he was charged with receiving stolen goods, but returned in 1961, having set up, run, and then sold a legitimate company during his time away, and managed to avoid the charge against him. With his brother Eddie on board, Charlie set about expanding his business interests, both legitimate and illegal. By 1966, the brothers and the gang they had built up around them was running one of the most successful and sophisticated criminal networks that England has ever seen. They had interests in everything from airport ticket machine fraud to fruit machine rackets, long firm swindles with added arson, to clubland extortion and diamond smuggling. Charlie always hated the word gang, seeing his organisation only as a group of business associates, saying, "Gangs are what kids have, or big kids in American films." They ruled through fear of the violent retribution that would be dealt out to anyone who crossed them, and yet it was this retribution that brought about their downfall. In 1966, a squad of 100 Scotland Yard detectives seized the Richardson brothers and 11 of their associates. They were charged with torture and other violent crimes against an assortment of criminals who had tried to cheat them. The police may have overstated tales of the Richardson system of kangaroo courts and torture, but there is certainly sufficient evidence of electrodes being attached to certain delicate body parts, and other bits being removed without anaesthetic, for Charlie to receive the longest sentence for grievous bodily harm, 25 years, ever handed out by a British court. His brother got sent down for 10 years. Eddie Richardson was released in 1976, However, in 1990 he received another 25 years for smuggling cocaine. On his release from prison in 1984, Charlie Richardson went to work in the City of London, carving out a successful career in the financial markets. His universally well-regarded brain helped him to reap legitimate rewards on the stock exchange. Interestingly, Charlie has commented that the city is far more dishonest than anything I did before, and perhaps jokingly that the biggest organised crime in Britain was performed by the government, stealing something the British people already owned and selling it back to them, the privatisation of nationalised industries under Margaret Thatcher. Of the many insights Charlie Richardson has made since becoming a widely respected and purely legitimate businessman, the most controversial is possibly his suggestion that the most lucrative, powerful and extensive protection racket ever to exist was administered by London's Metropolitan Police. What could sound like a meaningless jibe at the honesty of Scotland Yard's officers is unfortunately supported by a sordid history of fact. It shows not only police extortion of criminals, but also active collusion between many in the Metropolitan Police and the organised criminal underworld, and goes back more than 50 years. Research has proved that some Met officers are drawing two salaries, one official one and one from Billy Hill, while others were known to have colluded in major heists, such as Hill's infamous East Castle Street job in 1952. Richardson's claim that he made regular payments to the police, and that it was a sort of tax on crime, may have seemed fanciful at the time of his arrest in 1966, but it later became clear he was speaking from a position of knowledge. In 1969, the Times newspaper revealed that there was a firm within a firm, corrupt police officers within the Metropolitan Police, who could arrange for charges to be dropped in exchange for large cash sums. Following this eye-opener, three officers were charged, but bigger scandals were yet to come. In 1972, the Sunday People newspaper printed pictures of the head of the flying squad, Commander Ken Drury, holidaying with noted Soho villain and pornographer Jimmy Humphreys. When Humphreys was charged with a severe slashing in 1973, he revealed that the Dirty Squad, the nickname for the obscene publication squad responsible for tackling illegal pornography, were really dirty cops. His evidence showed Commander Wally Virgo and Detective Chief Superintendent Bill Moody received thousands of pounds to turn a blind eye to organised crime in Soho. Both men were convicted, while a host of junior officers also received prison sentences. In the wake of the judge's statement that elements of the police had been operating a vast protection racket, the Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, Sir Robert Mark, ironically remarked, "A good police force is one that catches more criminals than it employs." In 1978, he instigated Operation Countryman, costing £4 million and involving a task force of more than 200 officers working for 4 years. Despite massive obstruction, Operation Countryman saw the mainly rural Dorset police force investigate Scotland Yard for corruption. Their report has never been made public, but it is known that they recommended that nearly 300 officers should face criminal charges for corruption and colluding with organised criminals. However, only 4 officers were eventually prosecuted. In 1994, Metropolitan Police Commissioner Sir Paul Condon told Parliament that his force contained 250 bent officers. A decade on, only a handful of these have been successfully charged.
That's the latest in our series on The History of Organised Crime, a book by David Southwell. And we do hope to be speaking to David at the end of the series, which will be in a few weeks' time. Read there by Malcolm Grieve. The inquest into Princess Diana's tragic death took more than 10 years to happen, and even then left many questions unanswered. We continue now with the serialisation of what is Diana's most well-known interview with the BBC's Martin Bashir. It was watched back in 1995, just 2 years before she died, by Panorama's biggest ever television audience. Surprisingly, though, it's never been heard since, until now. We go to part four, and it's dated back in 1987. This is the time that she's talking about. In public, the royal couple continue their duties, but it proved impossible to lead a double life.
You're effectively living separate lives, yet in public there's this appearance of this happily married royal couple. How was this regarded by the royal family?
I think everybody was very anxious because they could see there were complications but didn't want to interfere, but were there, made it known that they were there if required.
Do you think it was accepted that one could live effectively two lives, one in private and one in public?
No, because, again, the media was very interested about our setup, inverted commas. When we went abroad, we had separate apartments, albeit we're on the same floor, so of course that was leaked, and that caused complications. But Charles and I had our duty to perform, and that was paramount.
So in a sense you coped with this, these two lives, because of your duty?
Mm-hmm. And we were a very good team in public, albeit what was going on in private, we were a good, good team.
Some people would find that difficult to reconcile.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's their problem. I know what it felt like.
The Queen described 1992 as her annus horribilis, and it was in that year that Andrew Morton's book about you was published.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever meet Andrew Morton or personally help him with the book?
I never met him, no.
Did you ever personally assist him with the writing of his book?
A lot of people saw the distress that my life was in, and they felt it was a supportive thing to help in the way that they did.
Did you allow your friends, your close friends, to speak to Andrew Morton?
Yes, I did.
Why?
I was at the end of my tether. I was desperate. I think I was so fed up with being seen as someone who was a basket case, because I am a very strong person, and I know that causes complications in the system that I live in.
How would a book change that?
I don't know. Maybe people have a better understanding. Maybe there's a lot of women out there who suffer on the same level but in a different environment, who are unable to stand up for themselves because their self-esteem is cut into two. I don't know.
What effect do you think the book had on your husband and the royal family?
I think they were shocked and horrified and very disappointed.
Can you understand why?
Well, I think Mr. Dimbleby's book was a shock to a lot of people and disappointment as well.
What effect did Andrew Morton's book have on your relationship with the Prince of Wales?
Well, what had been hidden, or rather what we thought had been hidden, then became out in the open and was spoken about on a daily basis. And the pressure was for us to sort ourselves out in some way. Were we going to stay together or were we going to separate? And the word separation and divorce kept coming up in the media on a daily basis.
What happened after the book was published?
Well, we struggled along. We did our engagements together. And in our private life, it was obviously turbulent.
Did things come to a head?
Yes, slowly, yes. My husband and I, we discussed it very calmly. We could see what the public were requiring. They wanted clarity of a situation that was obviously becoming intolerable.
So what happened?
So we got the lawyers together, we discussed separation. Obviously there were a lot of people to discuss it with, Prime Minister, Her Majesty. And then it moved itself, so to speak.
By the December of that year, as you say, you'd agreed to a legal separation.
Mm-hmm.
What were your feelings at the time?
Deep, deep, profound sadness. We had struggled to keep it going, but obviously we both run out of steam. And in a way, I suppose it could have been a relief for us both that we'd finally made our minds up. But my husband asked for separation and I supported it.
It was not your idea?
No, not at all. I come from a divorced background and I didn't want to go into that one again.
What happened next?
I asked my husband if we could put the announcement out before the children came back for school, for Christmas holidays, because they were protected in the school they were at. And he did that. And it came out on December the 9th. I was on an engagement up north. I heard it on the radio. And it was just very, very sad. Really sad. A fairy tale had come to an end. And most importantly, our marriage had taken a turn. A different turn.
Did you tell your children that you were going to separate?
Yes. I went down a week beforehand and explained to them what was happening. And they took it, as children do, lots of questions, and I hoped I was able to reassure them. But who knows?
What effect do you think the announcement had on them?
I think the announcement had a huge effect on me and Charles, really. And the children were very much out of it in the sense that they were tucked away at school.
Once the separation had occurred, we move into 1993. What happened during that period?
People's agendas changed overnight. I was now separated, wife to Prince of Wales. I was a problem. I was a liability, seen as. And how are we going to deal with her? This hasn't happened before.
Who was asking those questions?
People around me, people in this environment, and...
The royal household?
People in my environment, yes, yeah.
And they began to see you as a problem?
Yes, very much so. Mm-hmm.
How did that show itself?
By visits abroad being blocked, by things that had come naturally in my way being stopped, letters going, got lost, and various things.
So despite the fact that your interest was always to continue with your duties, you found that your duties were being held from you?
Yes. Everything changed after we separated, and life became very difficult then for me.
Who was behind that change?
Well, my husband's side were very busy stopping me.
That was part four of Princess Diana, Queen of Hearts, where the Panorama BBC interviewer was Martin Bashir. And next week we'll hear part five, which is 1992. A transcript of a phone conversation between Diana and James Gilby is published. That's the end of this week's Dialect from the Bristol Radio Co-op, based in Queen Square in the city centre, and broadcasting on BCFM 93.2. Today's studio guest was Susie Fitzsimmons from Lifeline, a charity that supports prisoners. Next week, more from the Mafia. We hear more on the Mafia and from Princess Diana, and also it's Mohammed Al-Haddad time. He's now back in Bristol after his 5,000-mile trip to Gaza, and he'll be coming in to tell us all about the trip next week. Our guest musician was Rachel Edmondson. Her website is www.myspace.com/queensofpretension. Malcolm Grieve read another instalment of The History of Mafia. Anthea Page interviewed Paldon Giazzo. The What's On was presented by Jeff Sparks. Mark Condon was our studio engineer with his assistant, Vilas Chitrakaran. This week's show was produced by John Peters Coleman. You can download the show on the internet at dialectradio.co.uk and find BCFM on the web at www.bcfm.org.uk. You can email us on Bristol Radio Co-op, that's all one word, at hotmail.co.uk. Don't forget, if you want to support the people of Tibet, fly the Tibetan flag in your home, workspace or garden. So it's goodbye from all of us here at dialectradio.co.uk, and it's goodbye from me, Tony Gosling. Until next week, goodbye.